Why so serious?
All the toys, all the time.
I am the game, and still getting trying to play dude.
You know the rules. This isn't a toy.
But we bought it at the toy store.
We did, but the way I'm using it makes it an adult thing.
Are you ready to play the game?
Yeah! Welcome to the toy department with Matt Kolsky and Derek Madden.
Yeah. I'm giggling at the start of this toy department. I probably shouldn't have done that.
Do I include the cough?
Yeah.
When I edit it together?
Yeah, probably. All right. I'm Derek Madden. He's Matt Kolsky. Clearly, the show prep's going well today, so banner show for you.
Coming up today, laughing. It's better than if you were, like, angry.
It's true. I don't think we've ever had a pre-show fight before.
I don't recall.
All our heated arguments have been on the podcast, I think.
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah.
It's probably for the best.
I think so.
Got to get all the drama on tape.
Yeah.
Are you expecting drama and fireworks in today's show? We're talking about Escape from Dannemora on this episode.
I can think of one place I might get a little pushback.
Yeah? All right. Me too. I'm curious if it'll be the same place or not.
Okay.
All right. So I guess we should start the show. I'm going to clear out a little bit.
I'm going to clear out.
Yeah, you're going to clear out a little bit.
Yeah.
And I'm gonna play some ISO ball on the wing on Lifetime's surviving R. Kelly. So we've talked a lot, I think, of various points about the R. Kelly saga.
Yes.
Over the show.
It's probably. Oh, by the way, I forgot to mention today is episode 150. Congratulations to you.
Oh wow.
Which means it's probably been about 2 years since you convinced me to delete my R. Kelly.
I'm proud of that. I'm proud of that. You are certainly not the only person that I have convinced to do this. Which is why I'm glad this show exists. Now, you have very willfully abstained from surviving R. Kelly the show. Like, you're just out, correct?
Did you say willfully? Yes, yeah. I've willfully abstained. That's yeah, I just don't. Like I said, it's been a couple years since I decided to be all out on R. Kelly. And, like, that kind of, to me, includes revisiting the reasons why I'm all out.
Yeah, and you are just, you know, I also think it just generally falls under your bad time TV.
There's so much stuff for me to watch. Why do I want to spend hours miserable?
And, you know, I'm going to make the case for you, but certainly for anybody else to watch this show. But I'm going to start with it's bad time TV. Like, there's no getting around that. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, you're not going to feel good, and it's, you know, it's 6 hour long episodes of all that. Probably, you know, if we're being honest, probably could have been 4 or 5. There's definitely some padding. You know what I mean? And lots of, you know, there's lots of summarizing what you've seen before and teasing what you're going to see ahead, almost in like a, you know, like a Bachelor kind of way where there's, you know, they're repeatedly doing that. But that's kind of what you have to do when you spread out a documentary over 5 nights, I think, right? So,
I guess so. Apparently so.
Yeah. But as bad a time as it is, because the stuff that you hear and see and witness is disturbing, hard to believe. But it's also riveting. And this was just going to be a thing that I watched and you didn't watch, and that didn't come up on this show. But I wanted to talk about it because I started watching it after the football on Sunday. you know, so fairly late at night, and like I plowed through four of them, like right away. Like it is, I mean, it is, it's gripping. It's gripping television. Despite the fact that it is deeply, deeply sad. I get your point too, in that you already know that this guy is a monster, and you have a pretty good idea of what he did. I have spent a lot of time, you know, I read all the Jim DeRogatis reporting back in the day. You know, I've been on this Mute R. Kelly bandwagon for a long time, before there was a hashtag. So I didn't really think that I was going to learn a whole lot. I just thought it was going to be summations of, you know, stuff I already knew that he did. Yeah. I was very wrong. Like, first of all, it's an ongoing situation, this thing that's happening. Like,
yeah.
As I speak these words, there are women who are being emotionally, physically, and sexually abused in one of the various houses that he has. And you know, some of the footage they get, you know, mothers trying to, and fathers, trying to free their young daughters from the clutches of this guy are, I mean, it's emotional. It's emotional to watch. And yeah. what's crazy, you know, about it is, as you watch these stories, like these refrains from separate people, like, keep coming up, you know, like, you keep hearing people say, like, well, you know, we didn't know the storm that was coming, or, right. you know, we didn't know the bomb that was about to go off, or I just wish I'd never introduced so-and-so family member to R. Kelly. Ugh. And you realize that this guy not only is a destroyer of young girls, which is awful, but of entire families too. Like the wreckage that this guy causes in people's lives is horrific. And it, to hear it from the people who lived it, and they have family members of R. Kelly, they have his ex-wife, they have one of the girls who was on the sex tape that, you know, that was on display in that trial and that got bootlegged everywhere. You know the tape I'm talking about, right?
Of course, yeah, of course.
Who not only is on the tape, was the one who found the tape and, you know, basically, you know, got it out of that house that allowed everyone to see it. So, you know, it's people who are there. And people who would tell you directly. And the fact is that in this day and age, there are still people who think this is like a he said, she said thing, or they don't really know what happened. And, you know, you watch this documentary and it's almost inarguable what happened, because you had multiple witnesses telling you multiple stories over multiple years. And it's the same thing. And just the sheer audacity of what this man did. I mean, they talked to a girl who he picked up at the child pornography trial when she was 14. He was picking up girls at his own trial. And, you know, that's far from the most shocking thing that you will hear. And you know, I say to people, like, I totally get why you think you might not want to watch this, and I understand it. But I would also say, part of what has allowed this to happen is a cognitive dissonance that only exists because we look away from what this man is doing.
Right.
You know, R. Kelly still has a record deal right now, and that can only be possible because we decide that we don't want to see what's happening right in front of our eyes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I mean, everything you said is true, obviously.
So, yeah. So, look, it's a bad time, but it's good TV. You know, right. I mean, like, from an execution standpoint, you know, it's certainly a documentary trying to make a point. It's definitely a documentary that has a perspective. And they use some tricks, you know, like, there's definitely some echo and some sound modification and some stuff. But it, I really think it's worth seeing. And if you don't know anything about the story, I can't encourage you enough to just look into this and know, because the decision of, like, whether or not you want to participate in R. Kelly, the artist, like, it's very easy to make once you watch this thing. Like, you just, you know, trust me on that. So, I really recommend Surviving R. Kelly highly. I'm not sure, like, I know a Lifetime kind of threw it all out there in 1 week. I'm not sure what the air schedule is at this point, but it's worth seeking out. Like, if you don't know the story, you won't even believe it. It's wild that this has been going on in the public eye for almost 30 years now.
It sure is.
Yeah. And I promise you, there's stuff you didn't know. Like, I didn't know that there wasn't just young girls. He abused lots of older women too. And, you know, like I said, I didn't know how much of the stuff was ongoing. I didn't know some of the stuff, you know, about these houses and what was happening in these houses. There's a scene where, you know, now R. Kelly's fallen some harder times lately. And he had
which he likes to complain about.
Yeah. So he had to he owed back rent on a couple of his mansions, and he had to get rid of them.
They got repossessed.
So they take one of the women who was trapped in one of these things, you know, to the empty mansion, you know, so she can kind of show the cameras around. Mm-hmm. And, like, when you watch her and she's given this tour, and, like, she's like, this was my room. And, like, she can't even bring herself to open the door of the empty room. And instead, you wind up going to this other room that she explains was what they called the dark room, which I guess was the room where most of the sex stuff happens. And, like, as she's kind of explaining this, like, she just starts losing it and has to walk out. And it is just so heartbreaking to see this empty room and to know, like, you know, how much pain, how many women suffered in that room, and to know that there are rooms all over the country where this guy is doing this. Like, please watch it if you can. And that's what I got on R. Kelly. Sorry.
Fair enough.
Okay. I feel like maybe we should move on to something lighter.
I'm open to it. Should we
Should we go to Top Chef?
Yeah, I love Top Chef.
All right.
Wait, can I just... Did you watch The Last Chance Kitchen?
I did not watch The Last Chance Kitchen.
Well, that's a shame, because it's going to come into play in next week's Top Chef.
Oh, really? Are they already bringing somebody back into the competition?
In the most dramatic way ever.
Interesting. All right. Well, I guess I got to watch that before I...
Well, we'll get there. Let's talk about everything else first. How far back? I mean, I guess we're talking about all of Restaurant Wars, right?
Yeah. So, I love Restaurant Wars. And, you know, it's always one of my favorite episodes. And I do think that the switch of doing it earlier this year and having three teams made for a more interesting Restaurant Wars, don't you think?
Yeah, I think it. I do. Although it definitely, for whatever reason, seems like it made for a more frantic and like less successful Restaurant Wars.
Yeah,
right?
Well, I think there's a reason for that, right? This is like usually when you do it midway through the season, you've sort of cut the bottom half of the chaff away, right?
Right.
So you have a more even talented group of chefs, right?
But it was surprising to see who was, like, the limiting folks on any given team, right?
Yeah. Okay, spoiler alert, by the way. I feel like we should throw that out there. If you haven't watched the Restaurant Wars episodes of Top Chef, you should fast forward now, because there's no way to talk about it without talking about what happened.
Yeah, this is why I put the time signatures in the description, so you can jump to the next topic if you so choose.
Yeah, okay. So, the problems didn't come from necessarily where you expect. I want to raise something, and I'm going to give a shout out to the Pack Your Knives podcast, which is entirely devoted to Top Chef, but they had a restaurant expert on who raised this point, and I kind of agree. Do you think it's fair for these chefs to go home for front of housework when that's not really what they're on the show to do?
Fair?
Yeah, or right, good for the show. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
I don't think fair has anything to do with it.
Well,
right?
It is a competition with rules and right. I mean, it should be fair. I know it's a television show, but
no. Well, in that sense, it's fair.
Does it make sense to send people home for things that are really not a part of a chef's job?
I'm fine with it. It's part of a restaurateur's job, and most of these people want to be restaurateurs.
I guess,
right?
I bring it up because they had a restaurateur kind of on the show, a guy whose main job really was sort of handling front of house for restaurant groups.
It was a lady, right?
I'm sorry, on this podcast.
Okay.
And his point was, not only is this like not a thing a chef should be concerned about, but like if he has a restaurant where he is a chef who's like getting into the reservation book, he's like, that's a real problem. You know what I mean? Like, this is a place where they shouldn't be.
Yeah, but don't you want your chef to know how it works?
I mean, yes, but like, I guess know how it works, but I don't know that that's an element for being a successful chef. The other thing is, right, you're setting these restaurants up overnight, and like, the wait staff, you know, on these shows seems to have no idea what they're doing, right?
That's the part that's weird to me, is they seem to, like, it's got to be deliberate, right?
Yeah,
they
see people who, like, raised their hand that said they didn't have serving experience before.
Yeah.
So, and everyone knows that I have been Team Nene on the show, and I'm a little bit bitter about her departure, but, like...
Yeah, I agree that's a bummer, but
and she
also,
was a total
like,
front of house, like, she was a disaster at front of house, but, like, that staff also had no idea what was going on, so... It's not really a total shock that, you know, they had a completely messed up ticket situation.
Right. No, I was not surprised the way that went, although I was surprised that Nene was so apparently incompetent as far as front of house stuff went, and I was surprised that that was one of the teams that struggled so much, although in the end it really did seem like everyone struggled.
It did, although I would also say, and I say this as a proud member of Team Nene, you know, on the basis, if you say yes, you know, it's this front of house thing is important and a part of the competition. If you're agreeing to those basic principles of the show, she clearly deserved to go home, right? Like, I was like, halfway through the first episode, I was like, oh, this is bad. And like, by halfway through the second episode, I was like, oh. If they're sending two people home, she has no chance. Like, she's gone.
Correct.
You know, served a bad dish, and that was as bad a front of house performance, I think, as as I've seen on the show. And they've had some bad ones in these restaurant wars, but like, you know, they couldn't turn tables. Everyone was getting the wrong food.
Yeah,
it was a nightmare.
And with her dish, it, like, I always feel bad. It's the same with, I always feel bad for the people on like. The Great British Baking Show on the really hot days, but like when they're like, it's 1,000,000 degrees and my ice cream won't stay frozen in the freezer, it's like, ugh, that sucks, man. Because I mean, I don't know if I would say you can't anticipate it, but it's certainly difficult to anticipate and a bummer that ruins your thing, but it's just part of the deal, right? I mean, you just got to I'd check the weather forecast or something, because that's what you got to do. So I don't know. I feel bad for her, but also she did not. I felt worse for the person. I forget who it was now, but what's her face? Natalie?
Yeah. The quiet executive chef. Is that what you're talking about? The pasta lady?
The skinny one with the tattoos.
The
skinny one with the tattoos who got eliminated for lemon curd.
Gotcha. The Philadelphia chick from back earlier when they didn't have enough lemons. Yeah, okay.
Her name might not be Natalie.
I think it might be Natalie.
Either way, she got eliminated in my mind, like, largely because Eddie effed up and screwed everyone on ingredients. I felt worse for her than I did for Nene, who, like, really screwed the pooch.
Yeah, I mean, look, you can argue about because Natalie, if that is indeed her name, gave additional lemons to other people beyond the so she had a role in that, I would say. But yeah, look, I mean, much of the blame for Nene's performance goes on Nene, but doesn't it also, like, isn't the incompetent waitstaff part of that?
Yes, but everyone had an incompetent waitstaff, and Brian somehow whipped them into shape.
That, by the way, that to me, if you're asking what the it is Natalie, by the way, Natalie Moronsky is her name. By the way, if you're asking what the most surprising thing was, that guy's like 3,700-page service guide
was effective.
Was totally effective and turned out to be the right thing.
Not only that, but when he initially was like, I'm a people person, I was like, you, dog, know your role. And then he was somehow, like, the most effective front of house person, which I just find so hilariously ridiculous, but also kind of wonderful. So I'm into it.
Yeah. All right, I'm going to ask a question. By the way, you can definitely tell, like, you know, this is a type A personality who's, like, channeling all his drug addiction energy into running service guides.
Yeah, for sure.
Like, it's just, his stuff's written all over his face. This is a question that you may know the answer to, being, like, a last chance kitchen guy. That I don't. But, so we've now seen Natalie, who looked like maybe one of the best chefs on the show, out. And we've now seen Nene, who won two out of the first three challenges, out.
Mm-hmm.
Are we losing all the really good chefs early? Because when you look at the results of people who are still in, you know what I mean?
No.
There's not a lot of winners left, right? Natalie won the first challenge, and then Nene won the next two, and they're both gone. So Brian is the only winner still left in the competition. And there's not a... Not a lot of high finishers left, you know?
There are plenty of high finishers, and I also think, like, they're all great chefs, right? I mean, if we've learned one thing from watching this show before, it's that they're all great chefs.
Yeah,
so,
it's a good group.
Yeah, so I'm not worried about that. It is a bummer we lost, personality-wise, Nene. I do know, I'm now going to spoil Last Chance Kitchen, she is gone for good.
Womp womp.
And what they did on Last Chance Kitchen was... Oh, wait. No, wait. No, Nene's not gone for good. I take that back. So what they did on Last Chance Kitchen, I think I have this right. People-wise, is they were like, well, Nene was eliminated on, or Nene and, who was the other person eliminated?
Pablo.
Right. Nene and Pablo were eliminated on Last Chance Kitchen, so we're going to do our own mini Last Chance Kitchen. You all have to come up in 30 minutes with a theme for a restaurant and one signature dish for that restaurant, right? And so it's Brother, Natalie, Nini, and Pablo.
It's a tough group right there.
Very effing tough. And they all do their dish. Brother does like a dish he does at his restaurant. And Nini's concept was Mekong Delta meets Mississippi Delta.
Gotcha. That's very on brand for her.
Very on brand. And they won. I can't remember what Natalie and Pablo did. Pablo was kind of a mess as usual.
I can tell you what Pablo made.
Okay.
Seared carrots with herb yogurt and pickled carrots.
Oh, right. There was like, he was like a vegetable-themed restaurant of some kind.
And then Natalie did pan-seared scallops and braised Napa cabbage.
Yeah, I just remember her being like, I'll come up with a theme once I get the dish. I just got to cook. And that did not work out for her.
Oh. Whoops.
So I was right. It's Nini and Brother, right?
Yeah. Brother is looking like he might be the last chance kitchen Terminator to me.
Well, except last time he lost on the final. And so what they did is then they were like, Tom was like, all right, you two win. Now, go home. And tomorrow, come back, and over the course of however many hours, I want you to plan a full three-dish meal for the restaurant you already created. Which was like, man, if Natalie had gotten through, she'd have been doubly screwed trying to come up with a whole meal plan for a restaurant. For a
concept she didn't have, yeah.
Yeah, but so these ones are pretty good, because Brother is like the restaurant he actually has, and Nini is this very on-brand concept. And then they brought in the full cast as sous chefs and drew knives to decide teams. So Justin ended up on Nini's team after throwing her under the bus. I don't think he really did either.
Yeah.
But she was pissed.
Oh, she was pissed. Okay.
Yes. She was pissed. He was like, whatever, no hard feelings. I feel like I told the truth. But obviously, she got eliminated. She was pissed. And he ended up on her team. And she's like, I'm giving him one job. And it's to just, like, fry some shrimp. If you could just do the one thing. And so he fried some shrimp. And then they freeze. You know, the Last Chance Kitchen ends before they tell you who wins.
Gotcha.
So we're going to find out who's back via Restaurant Wars Last Chance Kitchen edition on the next episode of Top Chef.
Wow. I mean, you know, look, they, and you know, I'm on record. The two people I was rooting for in this competition are Justin and Nini, so it's weird to me when they fight.
Stop fighting, Mom. Mom, Dad.
And I don't really think either one of them was right or wrong in that situation. Like,
no, I agree. I'll say this, too. I just think this, more than anything, is proof, again, that this is a tremendous, perfect reality show TV.
Yeah, it is.
To have like a feud between our two favorite characters, one of whom may or may not be coming back based on the work of the other.
Right.
Like, it is peak stuff, man. They really are. They are operating at the highest level.
Yeah they are. And I think these people, like, it's a show about, you know, outside of maybe like, you know, a reality show about the NBA or something, which I guess doesn't really exist.
No. Well, there's Hard Knocks for the NFL.
Yeah, or Hard Knocks or something like that. It's hard to say that anybody on television is as talented at what they're doing as these guys are that, you know, you're following along, right? Like, they're just – it's just really skilled – watching really skilled people work is a thrill in and of itself.
If you like food at all in, like, a nerdy type of way, the stuff they create is, like, it's this truly wildly beautiful – stuff,
yeah,
that even if you can't eat it is just like, wow.
Yeah. I've ever had one complaint about the show, though, you know, they're all so good at presentation, you know. Uh-huh. What I mean,
it's hard to say.
Yeah, it's very possible to have a dish that looks amazing on a plate and then, but, you know, has all sorts of problems with it, right? So a lot of times, you know, you watch the show and you're like, oh my God, it looks so good. But it may not actually be good, right? So
that's fair.
You know, and there's nothing you can do about that, right? So they make Scratch and Sniff TVs, I guess.
I mean, yeah. Well, it beats the alternative, right?
Right. So, but yeah, it's great television. It just is. They just know how to do this show. You know what I mean? And like I said, there are little things about it, and you go, well, is this really a component of being a great chef or a restaurateur? You could argue about it, but it doesn't matter because even if it isn't, it's still damn good television.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
You know, which is why we're here, right?
That's our job, so to speak.
Yeah. All right. Is Escape from Dannemora also damn good television in your mind?
Is Escape from is it damn good television? You know. Yeah, sure. Why not, right? I mean,
I mean, no.
Was the word great?
The word great is not good. I just say damn good.
It wasn't bad. It was good. It was good.
Yeah, like
was it? Where's the line? I guess between good and damn good. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, that's the word I was going to use. Was enjoyable. Like I watched it all. I didn't have a bad time. But I didn't have like an awesome time either. This is not a show that like where my jaw dropped. You know, like there are good things. It still to me felt two or three episodes longer than it needed to be.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like. Do you feel like you really understood? You know, despite the fact it was essentially a character study, right? That you really understood the three principles involved by the end of it.
Oh, the three principal characters. Did I really understand them?
Yeah.
I don't. Probably not. Probably not in like a super meaningful way. I really liked it. Does that matter? If I enjoyed watching it, it was well acted and well written and an interesting story. Does it matter? I don't know. It was good. It wasn't great. I hear what you're saying.
That's exactly what I'm saying. Basically, it's good. Yeah. It wasn't great.
The question is fundamentally like, is there a there, right? And I think the answer is, what are you looking for? If I can answer your question with another question, I think that question would be, what do you want here? Because was it a good watch? I would say yes, right?
Did you like it better than Versace?
Maybe a little, but I liked it in similar ways.
Yeah, see, I think Versace was better, and if you're asking what I was looking for, I would say better than Versace. Like, if you're telling me you got Paul Dano and Benicio del Toro, Ben Stiller's directing, Patricia Arquette's, you know, doing a body transformation.
Here's the difference.
My bar goes high. Like, that's what I want the bar to be like. Better than Versace. Worse than OJ, better than Versace. How's that?
First of all, that sounds like the first hit single from our hip-hop duo. Second of all, here's what I think about OJ and Versace that makes them different than Escape is I am, in the case of Escape and real life storytelling, I am most interested in the case of Escape in how in the heck did this happen than anything else.
But isn't like the answer to how in the heck this happened is it turns out to not really be that interesting, right?
Right, which I think is probably why it's not great. But I don't think it's necessarily a sign that there was a better way to do it.
Yeah.
Whereas with Versace and OJ, what I'm most interested in is the psychology of the principals. Because I pretty much know how it happened and what happened.
Right, but shouldn't the if you understand that the details, and really it's like all of the details of the Dana Moore story are kind of more mundane than you expect them to be, like whether it's the escape or the eventual capture.
That's the takeaway.
You know what I mean? Like, so it's like you would, you know, the show was probably wise to sort of focus on the relationships and the characters, but I don't know that it like did a great job of that, you know?
Like, I don't see. I think it did a pretty good job of focusing on the characters. I don't know how much you deeply know about them, but I think you know the way they lived over this period, the way they
definitely spends a lot of time with them, and it's good on details, and you really get the sense of like the bleakness of their day-to-day existence, you know?
Yes, of what was happening, of how they were living. Yeah, and that to me, again, those are the most interesting parts of this story, more so than the psychology of two sort of, in my mind, just average murderers, as sick as that may sound. There's lots of murderers in this country in jail, and I don't think they were particularly special ones.
Right, but the psychology of Patricia Arquette's character...
I don't know. I think we got into that.
We did, but I don't know. That was interesting, but I felt like, you know, like, they just sort of threw her there at the, you know, like, oh, well, it turns out she's been sort of messing around with these prisoners for a while. You know what I mean? Like, you know, there's a history here.
Uh-huh.
But you don't really understand why that develops, you know? I don't know. I just felt
I guess that's fair. It's fair to want that. That stuff did not super bother me in this case. I don't necessarily have a good answer for why.
I just feel like I enjoyed it. I watched it all the way through. You know, I was like, Sunday night, Escape from Dana Moore, cool. But, like, I got to the end and was sort of just like, huh. You know what I mean? Like, there's something not fully satisfying about it to me. Not bad. Not fully satisfied.
I mean, that's fair. That is certainly fair.
Is there any other parts of this you want
to... I know that's not a big response, but like it's, I think fundamentally I guess I essentially agree with you. I just, the difference is I think I was just less disappointed in the particular points that disappointed you. Don't disagree that I'm not telling you those things were great, that I read them differently necessarily, other than that
they just bothered you less.
Yeah, and they weren't, I don't know, right? I'm all about expectation management. So like to me it's that was not, they just weren't the things I was as interested in this show. So I think I'm saying this is what, a B plus, and you're saying it's a B. I mean, I think we're pretty close.
Yeah, I would say B minus, maybe.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're not that far off. There's like you're giving it demerits that just those are things that I didn't trouble me in this case.
Yeah. All right. It's interesting that you bring up expectation management. Because I think that factors really heavily into my view of The Favorite. Where did you land with this movie?
Yeah, so this was where I thought we might hit some snags as far as your, I don't want to say entertainment, or if I do, I mean it in the way of like willingness to entertain a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because here's what I think. Here's what I'll say about The Favorite, as it regards you. If we can get personal for a second.
Yeah, I feel like my feelings about this movie are very personal, so that's okay. That's fine with me.
So I feel like if this movie were virtually identical, in as much as this is a possible thing, were virtually identical, but took place in the 1980s in Chicago, you might have found it incredibly interesting and not unenjoyable.
No, all right. So I'm gonna stop you there, because I think that's wrong.
Okay.
In my notes here, I was like, yeah, it's a period piece, but it doesn't really feel like a period piece. It actually feels pretty modern.
Okay, that's what I thought. All right. Yeah. Okay, so go on.
Yeah, that's and
so why did you hate it?
In some ways, almost like too modern. Like, it sort of felt like it was sort of constantly winking at the present day, and I felt like
it was.
It certainly seemed to break into modern like language syntax at times. You know what I mean?
Yes, I thought to hilarious effect.
Yeah. So,
in fact, if anything,
it almost seemed like an Armando Iannucci like Veep style thing.
I was gonna say. If anything, if I had to pin this down, I might call it a satire.
Yeah. The reason that I bring up expectation management is because I feel like I might have different feelings about this movie if I had seen it just sort of in a vacuum where it was just presented to me and I was given no information about it, as opposed to the world I lived in now where I have been told how good it is, you know? Because I certainly, not only do I think it's overrated, I think that it's, the movie itself is about half as funny as it thinks it is. Which really, I found to be annoying after a while.
Sure. Okay. I think I'm going to pick nits.
Like, don't you think there's like a aren't we clever vibe about this whole thing?
Yeah, but I think I probably read it maybe like that vibe to me is 70-30 satire versus aren't we funny, and to you maybe the other way.
Yeah, I would definitely reverse that proportion where it's like, yeah. 30% satire, 70%. Look at us. We're funny.
Yeah, I just enjoyed these ladies goofing a lot. And like a vaguely satirical bent that I found very funny on a number of occasions, again, put me in probably the B2B+ range. For a movie that, like, ultimately doesn't necessarily go anywhere from a story or plot perspective. And I'm not sure if it has anything especially interesting to say other than, weren't people ridiculous in this time?
Yeah. You know,
that's true, and it is funny.
Yeah. And look, Ladies at War is great and entertaining. And,
yeah.
You know, oddly enough, you know, because you know, this is a movie that's largely about a truly incompetent and disengaged female leader. It sort of made me feel like we'd be better off if women were running things.
Yeah.
You know, because they're clearly smarter than
women.
We are. Yeah, right? The other women, right? Like, are just playing this game on a different level. You know what I mean? Right? They're playing chess when everyone else is playing checkers, right? So
it feels like we'd be about the same off if Olivia Colman was running things.
Well, yeah, the subtext of the movie is there's a very clear Trump Queen Anne parallel happening.
Well, and it doesn't have to be Trump, you know, it would have worked just as well for two presidents ago. So I think in that way it's clever in the way of just the mocking the absolute, you know, on its face absurdity of that time in history, which I found enjoyable. Like, that all played for me, I guess.
Yeah. And I certainly got the mocking of the on its face absurdity of that time in history. I just, you know, find that not very enjoyable. It's part of my period piece thing. Just don't care for it. You know what I mean? But like I said, I wouldn't like this wasn't, you know, for me, this didn't feel like a typical period piece. I didn't mind that part of it so much because, like I said, it did really feel like a lot of present day stuff grafted into a previous time. I just, you know, yeah. It's I don't know. It also feels like sketch comedy at times, like almost, doesn't it? Right. You know, like you could say this movie was like a series of sketches almost, you know.
Like these things you're saying, almost at times. That's why I thought those are things I kind of did enjoy. It was a goofy endeavor.
Yeah, it's a deeply goofy endeavor. I don't know. Like I found the acting performances, and this is again, it has nothing to do with the movie. It's not the movie's fault. You know what I mean? But I do find the praise for the three lead performances to be a bit much. Like Emma Stone's really great and winning. But, like, in the way that she kind of always is, right? Like, I think taken on the scale of Emma Stone performances, even, like, the stuff she did this year, you know what I mean? Like, it's to me, it's kind of like low-grade Emma Stone. I don't know. And I, like, the Queen's performance is fairly one-note to me.
Yeah, I don't know. I enjoyed Olivia Colman.
You know, but I don't like. Again, I freely admit
that
I'm not
sure I'd call it one note. It is particular, I guess.
I'm not sure I would feel this way if I didn't live in a world where I knew Regina King wasn't getting nominated for stuff, so that these three ladies could.
Well, she just won a thing. To be fair,
she didn't. She did win a thing, but you know. Also, the Hollywood Foreign Press gave her that thing, and she like didn't even get nominated at SAG. So, but again, the movie none of that is in the movie's control. So I understand that that's not totally fair, but it does play into my perceptions. You know,
fair enough.
Because I don't like. Would you agree? Like, there's not really like Regina King if we're making a comparison.
Yeah, it's a much deeper, more. I don't know. I don't want to say meaningful, but a deeper role. And yeah, I mean, it probably is more meaningful. I mean,
yeah, it's all those things. Just more, you know.
It is. It's more, and that movie should be nominated and winning everything. But I mean, and I'm okay with Green Book, but I certainly thought If Beale Street Could Talk was deeper, covered a lot of the same territory and deeper and better. So, you know, take from that what you will, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, look, one of the clear distinctions between those two movies is that Green Book has a much sunnier view, you know,
right.
Which I think is ultimately going to be made it seen by more people. But again, we didn't do a Golden Globes talk because it kind of came in the middle of these two shows, but you know, I always caution people. It's like the Hollywood Foreign Press kind of has their own ideas about stuff sometimes. You know what I mean? So,
well, they certainly took some weird approaches this year. That's for sure.
It's the first big award show of the season, and it tends to have some influence. But I wouldn't necessarily say like, oh, because the Golden Globes went this way, this is how it's going to go. I would not expect to see A Star Is Born losing out to Bohemian Rhapsody for the rest of the cycle. You know?
Yeah.
So. But we'll see. Who knows?
Do we want to get into the Globes a little bit?
I don't know that I have a lot else to say about the Globes. Other than like the hosting, you know, finding someone to host and present these shows and an environment in which we host and present them in is going to continue to be a problem. I don't mean that as some sort of like advocating for Kevin Hart. You know, I have my feelings about that, but that's not that important. I just think that with the Oscars in particular now, it's becoming a very thankless role, and it's almost like deciding to run for office where it's like, you know, you're going to sort of be a target then. And I don't, you know.
Yeah.
And I think it's like, making the shows itself a lot more sort of self-serious in a way that's not great for audiences.
I think it's like any big sort of situation, any big role like that where like I there's this idea that it's a no-win, and I don't necessarily agree with that. What it is it's it's only a win for a pretty specific set of people, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, who's won hosting the Oscars lately that you can think of?
Lately, yeah. No, you're right. I mean, lately, if I don't know if anyone's won. Lately, there are people who have done it again who have succeeded, right? I don't know if Jimmy Kimmel won, but it went pretty well, all things considered.
I mean, I thought it went well, but the Academy didn't.
Are we sure?
Yeah, they stopped out. They didn't want him back. So,
but that doesn't mean it didn't go well for him, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess. I do think, you know, if you could say maybe it sort of elevated his status in some way. I don't know. I don't know.
Clearly, he... You don't think he regrets doing it, do you?
I don't know. and I think so. Look, I also think Jimmy Kimmel's thing is sort of particular in like in that so much of what you think of his job hosting it has to do with him handling this sort of insane moment that just sort of happened to happen while he was on the, you know, the guy. So,
well, yeah, but I think he also got reasonably good.
I thought he did great. Like, I'm not here to say he did a bad job, but like I said, I think there are certainly some corners in which that was not viewed as a success. So,
all right,
I don't know. I do think it's difficult, and I think that, like, you know, and we all have our ideas about who should do it, but I don't know that like it's a win-win, even if we got our favorites in there, right? You know.
Yeah, okay. That's fair. And I'm not sure who it's right. I'm not sure who'd be good to host at this point is maybe the bigger issue.
It's Maya Rudolph and whichever one of the comic partners she feels like she'd want to work with, right?
Maya Rudolph and whoever the
Maya
hell
Rudolph
she wants.
And Amy Poehler. She wants it to be Fred. I know that would bother you, but I think it'd probably go off okay. You know, Sandberg, yeah, even. I don't care. Give me Maya and one other person, and I'm ready to roll.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, sure, that could work.
Keenan, whatever.
It's got. I don't know about. It's got as good a chance as anything, I suppose, is the real issue, right?
Yeah. But I don't. But like I said, I don't. You know, who knows who the hell they'll pick? Right? They still haven't picked anybody, right? We don't know who's hosting the show.
No, it's which is pretty ridiculous.
They're gonna
to
ask Crystal at the last minute, right? That's what's gonna happen.
I mean, don't you think they've already made all those calls? Crystal, Ellen, et cetera.
Bob Hope.
Probably. He was dead the last few times he hosted it anyway.
Yeah, I don't know. I am curious to see ultimately who they get, but I'm not sure how much is going to matter. I think it's going to be a boring ceremony anyway.
Wow. So hopeful.
Don't get me wrong, I'm still gonna watch and have a pool and everything because I like movies and I, you know, I enjoy the exercise of trying to figure out what the best movies are, even though the movies I root for never win.
Poor baby.
But sorry, I didn't mean that as a like. I wasn't asking.
My movies never win.
I wasn't asking for sympathy. I was just saying. All right, fine. So, should we talk
you
playoffs?
You get sympathy nonetheless.
Yeah.
Whether you
speaking
ask
of sympathy
for it or not.
How you recovering from the double doink?
Ah, dude. I mean, it's just I don't know.
It sucks to be on the losing end of a game that has like a title. Right?
Yeah. I mean, it sucks to be on the losing end of any, you know, playoff loss. I don't.
Yeah, I mean, look, losing the playoffs always sucks. But, you know, losing in the playoffs in a way that is special enough to name.
That's worse. No, you're right. I mean, don't get me wrong. It's
the worst. Look, losing to the Eagles with four shots from the 5-yard line last year. Sucked. Mm-hmm. It doesn't suck like 28-3 sucks. You know what I mean? So
no, You're right. It doesn't suck that much, but I'll tell you, it's a real bummer, man, because I think that team could have done stuff. I just think they were really good. I do. And, you know, to lose it that way, again, twice hitting, it just feels so specifically Bears-y and awful. And it's tough.
It does. Tough. It does feel specifically Bears-y. But mm-hmm. I promise you that there are 8 to 10 other teams in the league that if it happened to, like, if
they'd
that
say the same.
If that yes, happened here, that would definitely feel specifically Vikings-y. You know what sure. I mean? If it happened yep. to the Browns, you know what I mean? Like, it yes. would definitely feel
well, that's why
specifically Browns-y.
I don't want to be yeah. too dramatic because there's plenty of put-upon franchises, right? I mean, you're right, yes.
The Chiefs, another one, you know? Like, they're out there. Mm-hmm.
They are, yep.
Chargers. And sorry, stop naming sad teams.
Yes, there is much sadness, and such is life. Yeah. But, you know, it stinks.
It does.
It really stinks.
But your window is not closed, although nothing is promised, right? Like you can bring everybody back and run it back, and it'd go wildly differently next year.
And they're not going to be able to bring everybody back. There are free agents and somewhat critical spots, so it's, you know, this is life in the NFL, as it were. It's
yes.
It's sad.
It turns out winning
how,
a Super Bowl is hard.
Sport works. Yeah, it's really difficult.
Yep. Even if you only have a quarter to go and a 25-point lead. So I did want to ask you about something. There's sort of this prevailing wisdom that I feel like it's coming around now, like that you can't pay a quarterback. Have you seen some of these stories?
Prevailing wisdom, you're saying.
What?
Prevailing wisdom.
Yeah, it's like, if you spend, you know, because the 6 highest paid quarterbacks or whatever missed the playoffs.
Oh.
This year. Are you...
Well, I think, first of all, is Russell Wilson not one of the 6 highest paid quarterbacks?
He's not.
So who are they? Well, okay, Garoppolo's one.
Garoppolo's one. Kirk Cousins is one.
Okay, that's a bad signing, and I argued that from the time it was made.
Matt Stafford is one.
Again, bad signing, because he's not actually good.
Matt Ryan is one.
Now, that one is surprising. Why would you say, as our representative of Los Falcones, why didn't why didn't Matt Ryan make the playoffs? What's wrong with Matt Ryan?
Well, to me, that's this. He's sort of the thing that, like, kind of, to me, is why I don't necessarily buy this argument. You know what I mean?
Meaning, in the past, he's been highly paid, and they've still made the playoffs.
Well, yeah. I mean, look, you know, you could have very easily been a Super Bowl winner. You know, like, uh-huh. for factors that I would say probably weren't really his fault at that point. And I also think that he played very well this year. Like, I think he played roughly to the value of his contract. His numbers were very close to what they were in the MVP season. And there were just a lot of other things that happened on the team around him. Now,
which were what? That's why I'm asking. Yeah, what were they?
Mostly massive injuries along in defense. And I guess, you know,
which
some
obviously
of the,
could happen to anyone.
Right.
So,
and some of that is, I guess, the argument is like, well, you know, because you're not spending enough on the rest of your roster, you don't have any depth. I guess is the
maybe.
Counterpoint to that argument. But I don't know.
But
I
mean, look, you don't have a quarterback, the depth might not matter.
Yeah. By the way, the other guy on that list that we didn't mention was Aaron Rodgers.
Yes. Who I would argue had terrible coaching, and also. I would say he did have poor depth, but again, I look at that and say largely he had poor depth because his team was poorly managed over the past several seasons.
Yeah. I mean, look, there's the Packers are a whole thing to sort of untangle. I think it's weird. Like, would it surprise you if Atlanta and Green Bay and the Vikings were good next year and did make the playoffs?
Like, not at all.
I mean,
or
I guess
the, even,
I guess
even the Niners.
The notion that both or the Niners, yeah, like take three of those guys because the Vikings and the Packers being good at the same time is probably difficult just scheduling from a schedule.
Maybe, but as far as the Niners go, like they spent big on their quarterback knowing his first year or two might not be playoff years. That's part of the plan.
Right, right. So, I think there's now this sort of sense of like, you know, if you spend a lot of money on your quarterback, you better completely nail your draft class and then have all these really good low-paid rookies, you know, that you have to do one of those two things or you hit on the good rookie quarterback contract.
I think those are the best ways, yeah. Right? But as the salary cap continues to increase almost exponentially, those things become less critical. You can also go out and sign people.
Right.
You know?
And these deals look better over time. Like, look at the Russell Wilson deal.
Right.
You know, it already looks pretty reasonable, right?
And so, the Garoppolo deal goes down over time. That's going to look reasonable, you know?
Right.
And if the cap keeps going up and Aaron Rodgers maintains Aaron Rodgers' level, even his deal, the biggest in the sport, will eventually look reasonable.
And, you know, Seattle in particular, right, just kind of dismantled a highly paid, highly skilled defense to be able to sort of handle this contract, and it seems like they may actually even be better than they were last year, right? So,
maybe. But their defense was not good last year.
Defense was great. The defense was not good last year. It's fair. I don't know. I just think there are a lot of ways to build this team, and I think people are sort of overreacting to 1 year's worth of randomness in results. You know,
I think that's always true in the NFL. We overreact a small sample because we have small sample. But I will also say fundamentally nothing has changed ever in the NFL because fundamentally the way it works is whatever you do, if it's drafting, if it's free agency, if it's paying a quarterback, you have to do the right ones.
Yep.
So like
right.
if
paying,
you want to build
Kirk
your
Cousins
team,
$84 million guaranteed is not a part of a bad trend. It's just a bad idea in and of its face, right?
Sorry, who did you say?
Kirk Cousins.
Exactly. The problem is that Kirk Cousins is not the guy you want to pay $84 million. The problem is not never pay a quarterback $84 million.
Right. That's kind of where I'm at.
Yeah. Exactly. And it's the same thing with drafts. You know, I'm talking about the Niners on the radio, I get this ridiculous thing where when you tell them there's no reason to beat the Bears or the Rams in the last 2 weeks of the season because you want this number two pick and not number seven, people are like, you play to win. That's such a – it's a stupid edit. Why would you do that? They drafted Solomon Thomas with the number three pick, so what good is a – and it's like, okay, stop. Solomon Thomas may have been a bad draft pick. Reuben Foster was a first rounder. Okay, gotcha. Reuben Foster didn't work out. Fine, I understand. It's not debatable that when it comes to team building, a higher draft pick is better than a lower one. This is undebatable. This is a plain fact.
Otherwise, teams wouldn't trade other picks to move up for them. Right.
Exactly. It may be true that you can F up the best pick in the draft. Teams do that. Okay? So I understand there can be limited value to higher picks in certain scenarios, but it is not up for debate that picking higher is basically always a better thing. Always.
Yeah. Yeah,
so
I agree.
That's sort of the same attitude for me is like, wherever you pick, you've got to do a good job, of course.
Yeah.
No one's debating that. It's not like if you get a high enough pick, you can just screw it up. No, of course not. But if you choose to spend big money on guys, if you choose to draft guys who you think are going to be good with high picks, if you choose to whatever way you choose to build your NFL team, and there are multiple ways to do it, it's that the decisions you make along that chosen path have to be good decisions. That's what matters.
Right. Yeah, make good decisions. I agree.
Yeah. It's not that complicated.
I'm bitter about this because the Falcons did the same thing. And not only was the team very much like, we want to win every one of these games, but the media and everyone around the team seemed to agree with this for reasons that I just – fully do not understand. And then they turned out and won all those games, and now they're picking like deeply in the middle of the draft, and in a way that right. like why does that? I don't understand why that how that helps anybody.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean it is tricky because you know there's a to me there's like there's a limited degree to which wins can have value even if that value is not you know going to a playoff or yeah. seeding or
what is the right? margin of value like once you've been eliminated from playoff contention what's the margin of value of a win?
Well, like I think it depends at that point.
Almost
for
zero
instance,
I feel like.
Well, for instance, the 49ers this year won a game that I think ultimately cost them the number one pick and moved them to two, but ended a like 11 game losing streak to Seattle, their chief rival. And I would say that like that fourth win to go from one to two, that's fine with me. I'm fine with that. Especially in a draft where there's at least two guys people consider ultra elite. So for all the good feelings that engendered with the fan base, the positive results it seemed to have in the locker room, in particular because of Richard Sherman's presence and desire to beat Seattle, like, I'm into that. It might help them recruit Earl Thomas in the offseason. Like, I can see the value in that, although it is limited. I can see the value in that versus the difference between one and two.
I guess. But most of the stuff I hear is all about, you know, professional athletes and pride and competitive.
Well,
that stuff's pretty dumb.
Because no one, I don't think anyone is suggesting, I don't think you're suggesting that the athletes go out on the field and lay down.
Yeah, no, what I would like to see would be the Falcons, you know, when they were, what was it, you know, 7-9. So they were four and nine, I think they were. At some point.
So
yeah.
You sit down some veterans, some of your better
What I would like to see is that compete hard and lose for 3 weeks. That's exactly what
I want. Throw some young guys out there. There are things you can do to set yourself up to lose while still competing.
Ideally, lose every game by one point. Yeah, you know what I mean?
Yourself scouting the depth of your roster.
Right.
Like the Niners did that this year.
If you know you need defensive line talent, and you know that particularly this is a good draft for pass rushers, there's a huge difference between picking 12th and picking 4th. Huge difference. So,
yep. Well, that's the point. To me, 12th and 4th is huge. 1st and 2nd in this draft is not.
You know, and yes, is it possible to get the pick right at 12 and possible to get the pick wrong at 4? Absolutely, that happens. But, like, increase your odds, you know what I mean? And your choices.
Yep.
All right, we got to get going soon. So before we jump into homework, who you like this weekend?
I actually just submitted some picks for this, and I am going for AFC. Underdogs, NFC favorites. So Indy, LA, LA, New Orleans.
Indy, LA, LA, New Orleans.
So I'm picking the Colts to go into Kansas City and win, and the Chargers to go into New England and win, both of which seem insane on their face. I just watched the Colts dismantle a team. They were the only team that dismantled a team last week, a team with a good defense. The Patriots don't have an especially good defense. The Patriots offense hasn't been especially good, and that might have been the most impressive thing is how well Indy's defense played against Houston, which admittedly doesn't have Tom Brady but does have a dynamic playmaker in Deshaun Watson, who was essentially completely shut out. And I just don't know how good the Patriots are. I think Andy Luck is hot, so I'm riding the hot hand. That's the other one. I think Philip Rivers is hot, riding the hot hand. Andrew Luck going into Kansas City. I'm taking the Andy Reid thing, man. The Andy Reid thing, first time playoff quarterback. younger guy, as great as he's been, I'll take Indianapolis over Kansas City.
I am I'm going to roll with the favorites in the AFC.
Should have mentioned, because I was describing half of one game and the other, Joey Bosa and Melvin Ingram potentially injuring Tom Brady within one game of the big, or 1 minute of the start of this game.
Yeah, I think Andy Reid's going to Andy Reid at some point.
Yes,
but I think that the Colts defense is too vanilla.
I guess
for the Chiefs,
That's a fair criticism, because it is pretty vanilla. But I just think vanilla works. If the goal is to keep things in front of you, not allow big explosive plays, vanilla works in the NFL if you're really good and you're really, you know, you execute at a high level. And yeah, they did that against Deshaun Watson and DeAndre Hopkins.
I'm just saying, it's a lot easier to stop Deshaun Watson from creating explosive plays than that Mahomes-led Chief offense. You know what I mean?
It is. You're right.
So
it is.
That to me is the difference. There's just no way I'm picking San Diego on the road at New England. Just not. And then,
yeah. But you know, okay. See, this is one of those things. Where
I like the Chargers a lot, actually, but right. I'm just not doing it.
My thing is like, you know, sometimes
in a playoff game, not doing it anyway.
You're right to say that, and you're right to do it that way, and I'm wrong to pick against the Patriots at home in the playoffs. However, sometimes you just gotta like. If there's no argument besides like mojo, I just got to go against it, even if I know I shouldn't.
Yeah, look, it's not, cause, like, it's not just mojo, and I'm certainly believe me, I like everyone else think that this Patriot team is not as good as other Patriot teams, but they're playing this game at home for a reason, and.
It has a lot to do with playing in the
in
AFC.
A crappy. Well, that's one of the reasons.
Yeah,
but we've certainly seen them even this season step up, and play good games against good teams.
Yeah,
you know, the Belichick coaching advantage is not just that's not just a mojo thing. Like, that's a real thing. And then you know, likewise, some of it is the opponent and what we've seen from them in big playoff spots in the past. So I'm just that's the way I'm rolling. I could be wrong, but.
Look, that's all reasonable. But I think if you match up the football teams, the Chargers win in almost every category. And for me, that's why, like, you're right. Phillip Rivers could pull a Phillip Rivers. Like, there's a million ways this could go wrong for me, and I am deeply aware, like, significantly aware of that.
Yeah.
That is not lost on me. The fact that, like, I not only could, but probably deserve to and likely will lose in this case.
Yeah, not only could you lose, when it happens, you will be like, oh, why did I pick the Chargers? You know what I mean, right? Like, you're going to be,
exactly.
You'll be mad at yourself.
True. However, like, I still look at the matchup and think, why wouldn't I pick the better football team to win?
Oh, look, I see where you're coming from. I definitely see where you're coming from. But I'm rolling the other way. And then we didn't get to my NFC picks. I'm taking the Saints.
Yep.
And I'm taking Dallas.
Yeah, I thought about Dallas. I like wrote down Dallas, okay? And then I thought about what I watched on whatever, to Saturday night. And how determinedly and idiotically the Seahawks ran into the line of scrimmage again and again and again, and how quickly and comfortably Russell Wilson made plays in the passing game when given the opportunity. And I think, you know, Sean McVay has been creating opportunities for this Rams offense consistently and comfortably all season. I'm just afraid they're going to be
most of the season.
Most of the season. Yeah. And even in some of those rough games, Goff was bad, but they were open receivers. They're just open guys. And I just feel like if the Seattle passing attempts were any indication, the Cowboy defense may not be as difficult a nut to crack as it appeared.
I don't know. And I get what you mean about Seattle and the line, but I feel like that was one of those things where I think that they were really just trying to kind of wear Dallas down, figuring that they'd be able to run in the fourth quarter, and then sort of game script got away from them on that count, so they never really got to unleash that.
Look, man, I got some stats if you want, because it's a mess.
Yeah, yeah.
What they did is unforgivable play calling.
They went to the pass too late. There's no question about that. I'm not here to fully dispute that. Yeah. I just think that this is a good matchup for Dallas. The Rams do not stop the run well.
Yeah.
And Dallas can run it. I think the Dallas defense is very good, and we've seen them shut down some teams. We've also seen that the Rams don't necessarily react well to some of these, like, defensive slugfests. It's not necessarily where they're comfortable. And then I think you throw in the little bit of a side bit thing in that, you know, Dallas's training camps in Southern California, and they have a huge fan base down there. And I think that stadium, I'll just say the home field advantage will be somewhat mitigated by playing that game in Los Angeles. And I don't love this Dallas team, but I just sort of like them in this matchup. So I'm rolling with them, and if you're looking for a value bet this week, I really like Dallas money line because I think they're getting 7. So,
I like the money line better than the 7 because if this does start to go bad, I think it could go really bad.
Yeah. And we also don't know necessarily how healthy Todd Gurley is.
Right. I think he's probably okay. I got the impression he would have played last week if they'd needed the game.
Yeah, well, that's what they're going to tell you, for sure.
Yeah, I suppose you're right.
We don't know until we see him.
That's fair.
I don't know. Like I said, it feels like it's shaping up for Dallas, who I, again, don't think are that good. So it's...
Okay. I think we kind of agree with that. I think maybe you've made a decision to nap uponst the Rams, and I fear the reports of their demise may be exaggerated.
Yeah, I wouldn't nap on the Rams. Got a lot of respect for the Rams and what they've done this year.
I feel like they learned a lesson from last year as well.
I feel like they're slumping late. I feel like teams caught up to them a little bit defensively in the second half of the year, and I think the Dallas defense is really good.
Yeah. Well, I guess we'll find out just how good that Dallas defense is, because I know they have been good at points throughout the year. I also know they haven't been great at other times, and I don't know what to think based on the game I watched Seattle call against that defense.
I'm thinking more about the New Orleans game than the Seattle game.
Very impressive performance. Yeah. Again, they've had impressive performances. They got one of the defensive rookie of the year favorites, but I don't know if they're – look, the Rams really are – I don't believe the Rams have slumped into – not being good on offense. I just don't believe that.
Yeah, I don't believe that either. Like I said, I think Dallas is just styles make fights, and there's things about this matchup that just favor Dallas to me. And if the Rams were playing the Eagles, I'd probably pick the Rams. You know what I mean? So
that is fair.
Yeah. So there you go. Okay. That's what I like this weekend. What do you like to watch this week? Tonight we got an obvious one, right? Because You're the Worst is coming back.
Yeah. It is very exciting. It's a very exciting time.
I'm fired up for that. I've heard good things about this, which is going to be the final season.
Uh-huh.
So we're excited for that. Friends from College coming back to Netflix. Speaking of things we're excited about, I'd say we like that show more than most in the first go around. So.
Yeah, I guess we did. Although that was one of those shows I feel like was a creeper. People eventually came around to be like, you know what, that was good, because it's one of those shows, and we like a few shows like this, that, like, you don't have to be important to be good TV, especially if you're on Netflix.
Yeah. Yeah,
there's nothing essential about it, but it was really enjoyable, and it wasn't meaningless. It's just not essential.
You know what that show is? It's like an innings eating starter. It's like Rich Hill. You know what I mean? Like, you need some of those.
Yeah, well,
they're
but,
just gonna
yeah.
like it. Just throw up enjoyable hours of television. It's not the television that you want starting for you in Game 2 of the World Series necessarily, but.
No, but
you can't get to the World Series without a few of those, without a few retails.
Yeah, he could be your fourth starter who pitches some long relief at some point for you, and you're pretty happy with that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's what that show is to me. And then are you fired up for True Detective?
I am cautiously optimistic. Is that fair?
Because I would say I like True Detective Season 2 more than most. And I feel from our pod discussions, I feel like you kind of did too. And to me, Mahershala Ali is on such a roll right now, right? Like,
yeah,
he's been so good in everything. My expectation level is relatively high for this.
Yeah, I mean, there are certainly reasons to have a high expectation level, right? I'll say that. And I also liked it more than most. I'm not sure that's saying much. And I don't think it's
not saying much given the feelings of most, I think.
Right. And I think we also both agree, while we liked it more than most, that it did not nearly live up to the promise of the first season.
Yeah, it wasn't as good as the first season? No. But I thought it was actually pretty decent.
Yeah, it was decent.
Yeah.
After like an exceptional first season, I thought the second season was decent, which felt like a letdown.
Yeah. All right, fair enough.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see. So True Detective, anything else you want to throw out there? I mean, we're going to be watching some football, it seems like.
Yeah. Certainly we'll be watching some football. I feel like we came up with a whole list before the show. Did you not write that down?
No, we went through all the things I wrote down on the list.
I think we're probably good. I think we got enough.
All right. And, you know, of course, we'll be watching all the stuff we always watch.
Yeah. Yeah, man. Good Place comes back. We'll probably talk about that in a couple weeks. And, you know, if anything notable happens on Top Chef, we can always revisit that.
Yeah, for sure. Sounds good.
Bye.
This game's in the Admiral refrigerator. The door is closed. The light's out. Butter's getting hard. The eggs are cooling. And the Jell-O is jiggling.
So long, everybody.
And do me a favor. Have yourself a tremendous evening.